Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Are we here, Scott?
I remember a teacher that I had. Now, I went through the seventh grade. I went to the seventh grade. I left home when I was 10 years old because I was hungry. I work in the summer and I go to school in the winter. But I had this one teacher. He was the principal of the Harrison School in Vincennes, Indiana. To me, this was the greatest teacher, a real sage of my time, anyhow. He had such wisdom. And we were all reciting the Pledge of Allegiance one day. And he walked over, this little old teacher, Mr. Laswell was his name. Mr. Laswell, he says, he says, I've been listening to you boys and girls recite the Pledge of Allegiance all semester, and it seems as though it's becoming monotonous to you. If I may I recite it and try to explain to you the meaning of each word? I, me, an individual, a committee of one, pledge, dedicate all of my worldly goods to give without self-pity, allegiance, my love and my devotion, to the flag, our standard, O glory, a symbol of freedom, wherever she waves, there's respect, because your loyalty has given her a dignity that shouts, freedom is everybody's job. United. That means that we have all come together. States. Individual communities that have united into 48 great states. 48 individual communities with pride and dignity and purpose. All divided with imaginary boundaries, yet united to a common purpose, and that's love for country. And to the Republic, Republic, a state in which sovereign power is invested in representatives chosen by the people to govern. And government is the people, and it's from the people to the leaders, not from the leaders to the people. For which it stands. One nation, meaning so blessed by God, indivisible, incapable of being divided, with liberty, which is freedom, the right of power to live one's own life without threats, fear, or some sort of retaliation, and justice. The principle or qualities of dealing fairly with others. For all. For all. Which means, boys and girls, it's as much your country as it is mine. And now, boys and girls, let me hear you recite the Pledge of Allegiance. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Since I was a small boy, two states have been added to our country, and two words have been added to the Pledge of Allegiance, under God. Wouldn't it be a pity if someone said that is a prayer? And that would be eliminated from schools, too.
Good morning and welcome to Contending for Truth Radio. We're having some technical difficulties this morning. My studio computer, for some reason, doesn't want to connect to the internet. You know, how does it go? That's the way it just always goes. But thankfully, I've got my phone, and I've got a computer in the house. So if you happen to decide to call in and we don't respond immediately, it's because I'll have to run into the house every once in a while and check the studio in there and see what's going on with call-ins. You know, we're going to have a great show today. Dan and I love to talk history. We're going to talk a little bit of history. We're going to talk a little bit of politics. We're going to talk a little bit of faith. And as we always do here on Saturday Symposium on Saturday, when we come to Saturday, we do this early. And so we get up in the morning, and we're fresh with everything that's happened during the week sometimes. And, I want to start the program here. Because on a post last night, Dan gave an incredible story about really the first shot that was heard around the world. If you recognize that phrase, the shot heard around the world, we know in the Revolutionary War, the shot heard around the world was in Lexington. But Dan's got a fascinating story about that little state, Rhode Island, that we don't hear a whole lot about. And Dan, I want you to lead off with talking about this, because, this goes to a lot of what's going on today. Those early founders, those early forefathers were pretty sharp. And they did some things sometimes that, they did some tarring and feathering and molasses and feathering and all kinds of things. But they accomplished the task. And the things that they did then are what set the foundation for what we've got now. So, Dan, I want to welcome you down there in Florida where it's nice and warm. It's kind of sprinkling right here, actually, and a little bit cool. But Dan Wilson down in Florida, take it away.
Oh, it's nice and warm down here, and beautiful sunny day. And, when it came to that shot heard around the world, the fact was Massachusetts Bay Colony was far bigger, and Rhode Island at the time was a dumping grounds for all the undesirables. Yet this little state, with Connecticut bordering on one side and Massachusetts on the other, managed to do things that the bigger colonies couldn't do. And they had a time when they were shipping from New York to Boston. They found it easier to land in Newport and ship the rest over horse and buggies, because sailing around Cape Cod would add in a couple hundred miles. Well, the British, wishing to get taxes, elected to blockade Newport Harbor. And the way they used to blockade is ships bowed astern. So the British warships, or the ships of the line, could bear their arms to incoming merchant ships. And if they refused to pay the tax, they would open fire and destroy the ships. Well, the people from Rhode Island had the ability, and were pretty ingenious people. So what they decided to do is had the cargo ships anchoring off of Point Judith, where they transported the cargo into several smaller boats who would sail right along the coast, where the ships of the line could not bear their arms and shoot at them, nor could they follow them. Well, finally, one captain elected to do it. And the name of the ship of the line that followed was the Gatsby. And the boat he decided to follow was the fastest of our small little fleet. And her name was Katie. And her captain knew what was going to happen, so he told the people of Providence to be prepared to board the ship. He had sailed Rhode Island waters all of his life. He knew every inch of the entire bay. So what he did is, since the Gatsby, while in pursuit, only had one small cannon in the front, they couldn't do much damage. So what the Katie did was she'd slow down, let the Gatsby catch up, and then she'd speed off ahead of the Gatsby, frustrating the captain, who would put up more sail and get his boat going as fast as humanly possible. Well, the captain of the Katy knew there was a sandbar coming up, and he knew there was a little gap where his little boat could shoot through, and the Gatsby would follow in pursuit and surely run aground. So he slowed down to the point where the Gatsby was within 100 yards of the flailing Katy, who trimmed in her sails and took off. And Gatsby, sure that they should catch the Katy, barged in under full sail, and the Katy followed along just as expected, with the Gatsby cruising along at 5.5 knots, ran right up on the sandbar, and was so hard aground, they knew there was no way they were going to get themselves free. So, that night, as the crew of the Gatsby was trying to figure out what to do, the townspeople raided the Gatsby, taking all the crew off and rowing them across the bay to Newport, and let the crews go. They held one person back, the captain. And the captain, they did something quite memorable. They took his manhood away by shooting him in the genitals. But they had no desire to kill him, so they applied first aid to him immediately, the best first aid possible, and they nursed him well enough to the point where he could be transferred over to Newport. Prior to doing that, they sent two of our fellow Rhode Islanders over to tell the British to bring a litter to a certain point where they would meet them with the captain, and he was perfectly healthy. And they should send him back. Well, once word went around to the rest of the ships of the line, none of them wanted to pursue any of the small Rhode Island cargo boats again. And knowing they would never get the tax from the Rhode Islanders, they finally just admitted defeat, left Newport, and headed for Boston, New York, where they would set up blockades there and had a better chance. So that's the basic story of where the first shot was heard around the town rather than the world. And that was the actual first shot that began the Revolutionary War. 6 months later, Lexington and Concord would take place, and And then they would claim the shot heard around the world. So Rhode Island, because she was a small state filled with undesirables, never got the credit deserved. And and that was the beginning of the Revolutionary War. And back to you, Scott. And sorry about the extra noise.
Hey, it's all right. What a story, Dan. You know, I'll tell you what it reminds me a little bit of. You know, in the Bible, after Joshua fought the Battle of Jericho, and, you know, they marched in there and they marched around those walls. They won that battle. They didn't lose anybody. But there was one man took some of the things that they weren't supposed to take out of Jericho and hid them in his tent. And so they went back up to the next city in line, which was Ai, and they got ran out of town, and they actually lost 32 men, which doesn't seem like a lot, but when you're not used to not losing anybody, it's a whole lot. So they got things straightened out with the things that were taken that weren't supposed to be taken, and they went back to fight in the battle. And they used some strategy. God told them to use some strategy. So they went in there, and they got up close to the city of Ai and started fighting with the guys, and then they turned around and started running away. And of course, the men of the city of Ai chased them. They thought, here we go again, we're going to win. But what they didn't realize is Joshua had some people behind the city, and as soon as all the men ran out to go chase the Israelites down the road, they went in behind and burned the city. You know, sometimes you just got to use a little bit of strategy to accomplish the task. And then in the end, you know, you had to get tough. You know, there was a lot of tar and feathering going on during those days. And one of my favorite stories is when they had a young boy was in making fun of the Minutemen with a group of women, and they didn't tar and feather him; they molasses and feathered him. And you know that had to be one sticky situation. That's all I know. But you know what? It goes to show that those people were willing to fight. They were willing to fight for what they believed in. They weren't willing to deal with the blockade. They were going to get their goods in. They had to. And it's an interesting story to me because a lot of times we don't hear a lot about Rhode Island. You know, I'm doing states and capitals with my nieces. And we look at Rhode Island every day, and I look at that little tiny spot on the map. You can almost spit across it. But they got a great history, and they got some neat things to see there. But great story, Dan. I've got my internet back. It took me a little bit, but we've got it back out here in the studio now. I don't feel like I'm flying blind. You know, Dan, there's some wild things going on in this country, but we do want to keep our prayers. There's that flight over there in Malaysia that they find. And we want to keep our prayers with that. Latest reports are coming in. There were some funny things going on with the passports. And Melissa Bohannon just let me know in chat they're starting to look at possible terrorism. So you know, you don't ever want to root for the terrorism, but at this point, if there's a chance that plane has landed on the ground somewhere and has been hijacked, I would much rather know that than that it crashed into the China Sea, which it probably has a possibility of no. So we'll just keep you apprised on that, and we'll keep watching that, I'm sure, throughout the day. You know,
yeah.
Dan, let's talk about some politics, because I'm in a group of almost 14,000 people, parents and educators against Common Core standards, and there's a lot of people in there, and they're fighting, and there's another group, it's called the Badass Teachers Association. And there's like 35,000 people in there, and they're kind of a mix of group. In fact, there's a lot of liberals in there that don't like Common Core. And there's some other groups running around. Man, we are fighting Common Core like nobody's business. This time last year, this is about a one-year anniversary for me, for Common Core. It was about this time last year, I sat down listen to Phyllis Schlafly interview Orlene Coley, the California Eagle Feather president, by the founder of Eagle Feather, you know, Phyllis Schlafly. She's quite a lady. She was doing what you and I are doing, Dan, back in the 50s and the 60s, and she didn't have Twitter or Facebook or any kind of social media. She was a grassroots activist, and she was networked. And you know what she's most well-known for is helping bring the downfall of the Equal Rights Amendment, which would have been a terror for our country had it gone through. I'm all for equal rights, but like most progressive solutions, they're not designed to solve the problem at hand. They're designed just to do something else, and the Equal Rights Amendment was designed to do just that. But in the process of doing that, she did something very, very special. You know, there's three different aspects of the conservatives. There are the conservatives that are conservative for sovereign issues. Their big thing is they believe that the federal government cannot micromanage, like I. They believe that states and local municipalities should have more sovereignty, more control over their lives than the large federal government. There's another side of the conservatives, and that's the socially moral side of the conservatives, and I'm that way as well. I believe that as society's morality goes, so does society. And I don't just think that. I can point you throughout history where that has been true. And then there's another leg of the conservatives, and they're the economic conservatives. They're the ones that believe that capitalism left unfettered can really, really create a strong economy and create a better standard of living for everybody. And I'm that too. I'm all three of those, actually. But in a lot of parts of the country, there are people that stand on different legs of that a whole lot stronger than the others. There's a lot of conservatives running around that are morally and socially conservative that really don't fully understand the economics end of it and really don't even realize sometimes the sovereign end of it. You know, some of those conservatives I have to disagree with because they want federal legislation to legislate morality, and I don't want that. I believe the morality's got to come from the church and from each individual one of us. And I believe that the government shouldn't be tearing that down. But I don't think it should be necessarily legally legislating morality. But we've got those three groups together. And just like Phyllis Schlafly in defeating ERA brought those groups together, I'm watching these groups come together. And a year after I found out about Common Core, a lot has gone on. A lot has gone on. Many states have backed down. Many states have backed up. Many states are putting things through the legislature right now to say no way. Even California, Jerry Brown has even come out in the last couple of months and say, no, I don't support Common Core anymore. We've come to find out that it was exactly what we knew it was going to be when we first started looking at it. It doesn't solve the problem at hand. It's a huge, untested method of doing things. And when you start to really get into the curriculum and start looking at the curriculum, it's insane, Dan. You know, it's really easy to multiply 12 times 11. But when you have to write 14 different numbers, 14 different digits in order to multiply 12 times 11, you know you've got a screwed up system. But I want to take the next few minutes and talk about Common Core a little bit. Because, you know, we can go back to history, and Dan, you and I love history, and we can go back through history. And man has always known that in order to gain control, you have to really gain control of the people. And you have to gain control of the people, really, by starting with the younger generation. If you start to impose different rules and regulations on the older generation, and they're used to freedom, they're not going to fall for it very easily. But if you slowly but surely bring young people into a system where they don't have a whole lot of control over their lives. You know, it's like cooking that frog in a pot of water. You put him in there when the water's cold and he doesn't notice, and you can just boil him and he'll never grow out. He'll never jump out. Well, it's the same way. You know, Dan, I moved down here to Texas We moved down here for one of the big, huge elephants in the room was Common Core in California in the school system and making sure that these girls of mine can be in a good school system. But we come down here, and you know, we ended up back in the same pot. Because Millie's little school, you know, they got kids all over the place with little orange vests watching everything they do, and there's just different things that go on, and they're really trying to make a concerted effort to get these kids used to being watched and told what to do every second of the day. You know, they don't even have recess. They've got what they call brain drain, where they take some time off, but they don't go out onto the playground and play. And there's just a lot of things that are amiss. And folks, I don't want us to look at Common Core for the next few minutes as a detail. I want to stand back and look at our education and where Common Core fits in with that as a whole. Because there's some aspects of Common Core that are really, really scary. Number one, the big aspect that's really, really scary is the data mining. If you don't realize it, if you've got kids in school and you don't realize it, the school's trying to already collect as much data as they can for what's going on in the home. And that's not anybody's business. That's not anybody's business. In fact, if you take your kid to the doctor just automatically sends a note for you to send back to the school so the school can know that you've been to the doctor. And they want to collect stuff, and some of it's nefarious on the edge of corporations. Some of the corporations behind Common Core want the information for their own purposes. It's money-making purposes. Shame on them. But the other end of it is our government. Our government wants to get to a point where they've got a file on everybody and knows exactly what everybody's doing at every moment of the time. And that's one of the big, big problems with Common Core. Another big problem with Common Core is anytime you've got a centralized decision-making process on the curriculum, it's going to be abused. Now, I wouldn't want the Republicans or the Democrats centrally in control of our education system because I don't want Republican philosophy and I don't want Democratic philosophy taught in the schools. I want reading, writing, and arithmetic. Our schools spend 60,000 hours plus teaching our young people over a period of 12, 13 years, and we've got a bunch of them walking out the door that can't even read. Now, I had my 4-year-old, I taught her to read in 6 months before she ever even turned 4. She was already reading words. And now that she's 5, just barely turned 5, she's reading books. So it's not that difficult of a task, but our problem is our schools are spending so much time teaching, trying to teach everything else. They want to become the parent, and they want to solve every problem, and we've discussed that on this program so many times. You can't solve every problem. You can't whitewash all the problems out of your life. And, Dan, I'm going to say this, and I'm going to throw it to you for a discussion on Common Core. You know, my cousin was here not long ago. And her statement was, you know, there's so many parents out there that aren't doing good parenting skills that when the schools try and pick that up, you know, the parents that are doing sometimes get their toes stepped on. And, boy, I just have to disagree with that. It's not the school's job to worry about parenting skills. It's not the school's job to solve the problems in the home. It is not the job of the schools to solve the problems in the child. It is the school's job to teach them. Now, are there going to be kids that are living in a home that it's not the best going on? Yeah, it's been that way since the beginning of time. Do I wish I could fix all that and make it so every home was loving and kind and gentle? Sure, I would. But you're never going to do that, folks. And so you're dealing with Common Core down there. You've got a governor that's a dork dealing with Common Core. I'm afraid to say that because I supported him at one time. In fact, I am friends with some of the people in his inner circle. But he's a dork because he's not seeing some of this. Mike Huckabee's a dork because he's not seeing some of this. But Common Core is really, really designed to help the schools further push their nose into the home. And that's the big problem with Common Core. You can talk about testing. You can talk about curriculum. You can talk about all these other things. But it's really designed to help push the school's nose into the home. So, Dan, I'm going to pass it to you for that. I'm going to I got one more thing I got to do to make sure my studio's all the rest of the way set up. So I'll let you talk for a little bit, and then I'll take it back from you.
Well, the one thing about Common Core is, you know, we look at any totalitarian government, the first three things they need to do is first disarm the people so they cannot rise up against the government. The second is they need to remove the belief in a higher power. By doing so, they lose morality. So at that point, they're much easier to manipulate. And the final thing is they need to control the children. And that's so when they become adults, there is no having to control. These children are already programmed into the system. And that's what Common Core is doing. If you look at it, they make simple mathematics extremely difficult just so the parents cannot help their children with homework. And then their argument comes back as, look, your parents are stupid. They don't know how to do this. And, you know, this reminds me of an Abbott and Costello skit they did back in the 30s where they were talking about the numbers of donuts. And I think the number was 13. And Bud was trying to show through standard mathematics how Abbott was wrong, but Abbott kept on turning it around to show he was right. And this is basically what Common Core is doing today, is they're manipulating and they're using things so that they can undermine the parent and gain control over the child. The last time in contemporary times, this very same thing happened beginning in 1938. Although the person, the chancellor at that time, was a person by the name of Adolf Hitler. So instead of calling it Common Core or Obama Core or whatever, they just called it Hitler Youth. And we saw this happen not all that long in historical times. That happened not that long ago, in only 70 years ago. And what took place was a totalitarian government who wanted to rule the world. And he did something that is taking place right here and now over in Russia, where Russia is trying to take over free nations. And the people, just like they did in World War II, nobody is stepping up to stop this movement. And what happened in World War II was they waited until the Germans had taken over five nations before they made any type of aggressive action. And by that time, it was too late. We're seeing other movements in China and North Korea testing missiles that are traveling the same distance as they would if they were aimed at Seoul, South Korea. And we're seeing that in a third instance in Iran. And with the United States downsizing its military, they know the U.S. cannot fight three fronts at the same time. And their idea is to remove our allies and to gain control over a good chunk of the earth. And North Korea is backed by China, and China is supporting Russia. So we know that they are one single unit, and their next stop is Japan. And by the time they elect to attack our nation, that we are not going to have the ability to protect ourselves. So we're seeing the same setup that took place 70 years ago, and we're allowing it to happen. We have a president today who's doing everything he can to weaken this great nation of ours, and he has already removed God from our country. He is training our children, and he is taking away our military. And our these are all constitutional issues that are not being applied to. And we are, when we look at our Congress, who is the one that's supposed to be the one who prevents such things, they are sitting there and allowing all this to happen. Congress, their big excuse is, well, we don't have control over the Senate, so why should we make any moves? They don't need the Senate, because Congress holds the purse strings. And all Congress needs to do is say, okay, pass your law. We aren't going to fund it. And that would stop it, stop all of this. And when we go back to Common Core, the president totally bypassed Congress altogether. Common Core was never delivered in as a bill, was never presented to Congress, was never voted upon by Congress. And which is, again, a violation of the Constitution. Yet they have refused to do something. And what we need to do is we, the people, need to address Congress directly, because we're finding out that if we direct them on an individual basis, they are not listening. They are just ignoring us, and they're sitting there while atrocities are taking place one after one that we can't stop. So our only chance is by a show of power, and a show of solidarity, because there are Republicans and Democrats alike fighting against this. And we need to show our government that we aren't going to stand for this. We're being attacked from many, many angles, and it is time we stood up and we have to say something. So a group of us are taking their time to put together a rally while another group will be addressing Congress, and with hopes that between the two, Congress will no longer be able to say, turn their backs and say they didn't hear us. This is totally within the rights of the U.S. Constitution and is also the next step into preventing the inevitable. And we're trying to avoid a war through negotiation. But one thing that Congress doesn't understand, nor does the powers that be that are above and controlling all this mess, is that the patriot spirit still burns very strongly in many of our hearts. And we are not going to let this happen. We are not going to lose this country. Our forefathers put much too much into creating this nation. And this nation was not just created by them, but it was created through divine intervention. During the revolution, during every meeting of Continental Congress, every member of Continental Congress would get on their knees as a member of the clergy would lead them in prayer, asking for guidance from the Lord Jesus so that they can make the correct decisions. And God answered our prayers. Then when we are creating our Constitution, for the first month, all we could do was bicker. And once again, we got together, and Benjamin Franklin also addressed Congress and reminded the people that when we were in trouble fighting the British, we asked for divine intervention from God, and our prayers were answered. And he then went on to say that since we are no longer in combat, have we forgotten that we still need his guidance to build a nation, an empire? And if without God, he said, we will produce a empire like Babel that fell rapidly. With God, we can create an eternal nation that can act as a guide to the rest of the world. And that's what we created. And now we have in office a antichrist trying to tear that down. And it is time that we stood up and said enough is enough. And stand up to these, and stand up to the government, and say this nation wasn't created this way. it wasn't meant to be this way. And we, the people, are going to bring it back to where she belongs. And we are not alone. Our numbers are far greater than any of them realize. And this is what we need to do now, is start spreading the word. And when we get a date, a solid date on this rally, I'm asking each and every one of you to take the time to travel to D.C. and join us. While a delegation from all of us addresses Congress, and with these two things going on at the same time, we hope we can enlighten them as to the way we, the people, feel and view our country. And with that, Scott, I'm going to pass it back over to you. Are you there?
I am here. Amen, Dan, all the way along the lines. And I'm glad you brought up Ben Franklin. I want to talk about Ben Franklin for a moment. Because, you know, Dan, you know Ben Franklin well enough to know what I'm about to ready to say is true. If Ben Franklin had been alive in the mid-90s, he had been the first one to have his own website. The moment he found out he could put up a website and put information on the Internet so that everybody could access it, he'd have had one, man. He'd have gone in debt to put together his own website. Because Ben Franklin was a strong believer in sharing information. You know, a lot of people know when they think of Ben Franklin, you know, they think of glasses, a pair of glasses, and we got a picture of him in our heads of what he kind of looked like. Maybe the second thing they might think of is a kite and a key and a string and a lightning storm. But most people don't know that Ben Franklin actually opened up the first public library in the United States. Ben Franklin was a firm believer in sharing information, and books were expensive back then. He got together with his group of friends, and they got together, and they took to all their books, and they put them all in one room so that everybody could use them. Ben Franklin could use his buddy's books and everybody else, and you know, that was one of the key things that he did, and it's because he believed so much in the importance of free speech and the ability to get information out. He did a lot of writing. He grew up really, really fast from the time he was age 12. He was working with his brother in a print shop as an apprentice and putting out information. He took that experience when he went to England and continued that work there, and he printed lots of things, and you know, while he was there apprenticing for his brother, he took the opportunity to read everything he could. In fact, you know, he was the school lunch nerd. You know, he didn't go out to lunch with everybody else. When everybody else went to lunch, he most of the time sat in and found a good book and studied, because he believed in information, and he believed that these things should be passed. Of course, we know later, you know, things like the Farmer's Almanac, and he's more well known for, and many of his writings, and buying a newspaper. But he just believed in that. And you know, Dan, that's part of one of our problems today. We've got plenty of places where we can get information. The problem is we don't have people looking at that information. We don't have people utilizing that information. And if we're going to take our country back, we've got to get information out. This is the information age, and we've got to get information out. We've got to change minds and hearts. We've got to get people paying attention to what's going on. We've got to get people studying again and finding out why the basic principles that this country was founded on worked. You know, I would say if I walked through the neighborhood and started asking people why it's important to have a strong local government as opposed to letting the federal government control everything, I would imagine the majority of them couldn't explain why that was important if they even understood it was important. These are things people are missing out on. I think if we sat down to try and explain to them why this capitalist system that we've got is the reason why everybody's got 4 and 5 televisions and 2 and 3 cars and all of the standard of living that we've got, I would imagine that most of them couldn't explain enough about economics to understand why that works, to understand why entrepreneurism works. You know, Dan, you and I both know, we've had this discussion actually here recently on this show when we talked about the fair tax. But, you know, when a business, here's just a basic principle, and this is one of those things I would imagine that the majority of the people don't know. When a businessman starts to make his 5-year plan, and most businessmen that have got a business have a 5-year plan going at all times, they've got their goals of where they want to go to, they've got the things that they've got to accomplish in order to get there, they've got those written down on paper. But when they start to plan that out, if they don't know what the tax situation is going to be like next year, they have a hard time, and they pull back. They don't expend so much money. They don't hire people because they're not sure of exactly what's going on. It's one of the reasons why we need to fix our tax code. Because if a business owner really knew for the next 20 years exactly what his tax bill was going to be based on his income, he'd be a lot freer to go forward. You know, a businessman today, he doesn't know what the government's going to do to him next year. So, you know, he's kind of skeptical about taking and putting his foot out. You know, that's just a basic. That's a detail. But it's one of many very important ones that people just don't understand. You know, we talked also about embedded taxes. I would say that if I walked up and down the street and knocked on doors, I'd say that I'm probably one of maybe 2 or 3 people in this neighborhood that understand, if I said the word embedded taxes, what that even means. Now, we know that because when we started talking about 999 in the tax code, people just didn't get it. They didn't understand that 18 to 35% of the price they pay for a good is embedded, hidden taxes that they can't see, let alone the state sales tax that they pay on top of the good when they buy it. And these are all concepts. You know, Benjamin Franklin, if he were alive today, would be trying to share with people the information so that they could be educated and understand what's going on. And I think that's the key to what we've got to do. I ordered and I've discussed this, and I'm going to discuss it again, folks. If you ever get tired of me mentioning the movie Newsies, you'll just have to quit listening. I ordered Dan the movie Newsies again on DVD this week. Santa asked that I order that, and I'm going to tell you, it's the story that tells it the way it is. And I'm going to give you a brief rundown. You know, back in the turn of the century, you had Pulitzer and you had Hearst, and those two men owned the two major newspapers in New York. And they controlled what went out. They controlled the headlines. And the way they got the newspaper distributed was young boys, all the way down to young children, actually, all the way up to teenagers and young men would come buy the newspapers for a certain amount. Then they'd go out onto the streets, stand on the corner, yell the headlines, try and sell the newspapers, and then they'd sell them for a higher price, whatever the regular price of the newspaper was, and they'd get their money back that they spent on the newspapers, and what was left over was their income. Many of these young boys were really supplementing their home income. You know, the country, the state wasn't in the best of circumstances. There was poverty going on, and a lot of these kids were walking the streets working to help supplement their family income. Well, Pulitzer and Hearst were seeing dollar signs, and so they decided that they were going to raise the price that they charged the newsies to buy the papers in the first place, which, of course, cut out from the profit that they made, which was barely a little bit anyhow, on the other end. And there was nothing those boys could do about it. You know, you're talking about two men that live at the time, skyscrapers, kind of short buildings next to us now, but they were skyscrapers then. And they were very powerful men. And the newsboys decided, well, they were watching the trolley car guys and they were watching the garbage collectors go, the union strike. And they said, well, we need to join together, become a union and strike. And then we'll get the attention of the people and then maybe we'll get Hearst and Pulitzer to change. And it didn't work. They had a young newspaper man that worked for a small independent newspaper, and he was trying to put the story out, and they put the cuffs on him real quick and pushed him out. And so the young boys got together, and they decided, I got an idea. So they went down, and I don't remember if it was Hearst or Pulitzer, which one. I think it was William Randolph Hearst. They went down into the basement of his building, got out the old printing press, and printed their own newspaper. They printed their own flyers. And those young boys got together from every borough in the New York area. They all came together, and they put that information out. They got the information out. They got the story out. And William Hearst and Pulitzer both cried uncle. They cried uncle. The boys won. And how they won was going around the mainstream media and getting the information out on their own. And I just think, you know, that's a Disney movie from the 90s. It's a musical. It's a great movie. Christian Bale does a great job in that movie. It's got some beautiful music to it, and it's a beautiful story. It's a heart-touching story. But I think it's a really important illustration of what we're facing today. You know, we're not going to win the news media war. The news media is entrenched. We're not going to win our universities back. I think we need to start working on it, but it's going to take a couple of decades, even if we started pushing hard right now, to take our universities back from the far left. But I'll tell you what we can do. We're in mass. We're lots of people. And what we can do is we can go to our next-door neighbor and say, listen, do you understand what's at stake here? Let me tell you why I'm a conservative. You know, we got so many candidates out there that are running around telling exactly what they believe, and sometimes not even doing that. You know, I've gotten myself involved in a campaign this last year, and I won't mention any names, with a man who said, I believe this and this and this and this and this, and then he turned around and made a full flip-flop and said, no, I'm going to support this. And you know, it's because he doesn't understand why he believes what he believes. And I don't want candidates running around saying what they believe. I want candidates running around telling us why they believe it. Why they believe it. Because it's so vital. It is so important that we save this great nation. And I'll tell you right now, I really wish we had Benjamin Franklin right now. I think Benjamin Franklin would do a great deal of asset to this country because he would be all about pushing information today. He'd be all about the guy next door learning and reading and finding out what's going on in current events. He'd be the first one to stand up and say, you know, turn your sitcoms off a little bit and start paying attention to what's going on. You know, it's kind of fun to watch Benjamin Franklin as he goes through his life. Because when he's over, he goes over to England and starts to spend time there. And he at the time is a great supporter of the throne. He loves the king. He loves Britain. And as he stays over there and he continues to work and he becomes more and more successful, and he becomes an ambassador to the United States, and he tries to work with those guys over there, he starts to see that they don't give him any respect. And as you watch the story of Benjamin Franklin over there, he goes from a full, solid supporter of the king to lobbying France to fight against Britain. And, you know, that's a full, you want to talk about a full turnaround. And it's because he realized that the Great Britain, the king, they didn't want to share information. They wanted to tell you how to think. Our administration today wants to tell us how to think. That's one of the big problems with Common Core. Our administration wants to tell us how to think. They've told the school districts, they've told the superintendents, they've told the principals, they've told the teachers, don't tell the parents about this Common Core thing. Don't talk about it, because the parents won't know that this is really good for them, and we might get a fight. It's a matter of keeping things quiet. You see, I'm not afraid. I've never been afraid of both sides of the issue. You know, you got a lot of liberals out there yelling and screaming to get rid of Fox News. You don't ever hear me yelling to get rid of MSNBC. In fact, I want MSNBC to stay. In fact, I want everybody to watch MSNBC. Because if everybody was watching MSNBC, they'd see the hypocrisy. Will everybody? No. But the majority of the people that can think for themselves, They need to watch MSNBC, and they need to see where these people really want to go. I think one of the problems in our country right now is very, very few actually watch MSNBC. So when Miss Melissa Perry says that your children aren't your own, they belong to us. If more people saw that, I think more people would get riled up. If more people saw Piers Morgan and the attitude that he's got on CNN about your Second Amendment rights and how he wants to take all of your guns away, I think the people might start to wake up. I'm not afraid of people looking at the other side. I've never been afraid of a good debate. Put both sides of the issue up there and let the best side win. That's my attitude, but that's not the attitude of the left, and that should make you question folks exactly where they stand, because they don't want that attitude. Oh, no, 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 no. They want you to not listen to the other side. They want you to listen to only their side. And I would say that's because they know what happens when people listen to both sides. You know, they throw a lot of things at Fox News, and I'm not always happy with Fox News myself. I got a couple of issues with Fox News. Doesn't have to do with right and left. But, you know, when Fox News came out, it was designed to be fair and balanced. It was designed to show both sides. And, you know, you got Hannity and you got Combs, and they both share both sides. You got Bob Beckel is on there a lot. You got Kristen, oh, my dear Kristen, who over the last couple of 3 years has really started to turn pretty conservative. She has found God. I think she opened up her eyes. I'm still waiting for Bob Beckel to get his eyes open. But, folks, you know, back to Benjamin Franklin. That's what this is all about. I'm going to tell you, I think, Dan, and I'm going to pass it back to you, I really think Benjamin Franklin would have been the first person to have a website had he been alive in 93, 94, 95, when websites, people started realizing they could have their own websites. What do you think?
Well, Franklin was a person that was, he understood communication and the importance of it. And when he elected to drop his ambassadorship in England and became ambassador to France, he did this for a strategic move. And his son was coming of age at that time and was in the Royal Navy. And him and his father would get together, and sadly, they ended up never speaking to each other because the son still believed in the British hierarchy, while Ben himself saw the hypocrisy and how the British government was trying to micromanage from 3,000 miles away. So when he went over to France, he knew that his only way in to get the king to listen to him was starting to talk to the wives of the leaders. And, well, Ben was a ladies' man too, but he was a talker. And what happened is he knew that through their wives, he could get the information that the French wanted to hear. And this is what led him into getting the French to agree to commit their assets to the United States. Because the French were also at war with Britain at the time. And Franklin said, hey, I'll show you their weaknesses. And, you know, we'll do some trade after this war ends. And we'll, you know, end up with a good free trade agreement between the two countries, and we can both make some good money, which the French never turned down good money at that point. They were a monarchy that enjoyed the better things in life. So they saw the opportunity themselves. And, you know, at that point in the revolution, we were taking hits right and left. And it wasn't until the French got involved and took on the British blockades that opened the doors so we could get the supplies in that we desperately needed to fight the Revolutionary War. And it was all Franklin's, his idea and his work, and it came to talking. He understood the value of sharing information. And he understood that from a child. And today, if he had a web page, he'd have a web page, a Facebook page. He would be communicating in any way he could because he saw the value and he knew the value of communication and he knew the value that in order to win against a stronger adversary, which is to show a unified force. And that's what he ended up proving. He brought in Rochambeau, who came into Newport originally, and they went up to Providence and fought the British along the southern coast just south of Boston and worked their way up into Boston, where they got the colonists in Boston to agree to, who were furious themselves, but were not very unified. And he showed them the value of communicating. And they set up a regular system where they would communicate with New York, Baltimore, and right down to Pennsylvania and up through Delaware, New Jersey. And he had a regular communication route moving so all the colonies could unite together against the British. And though they forgot about the poor little state of Rhode Island, who said, these people are, doing this stuff and we're getting the Stamp Act and we're getting the shaft from every which way. We're going to shut the port down and we're going to tax the British and we're going to tax the Americans, American colonies, and we're going to do it on our own, which is why to this day, on the top of the capital of the state of Rhode Island is the independent man, because the colonies viewed him as nothing but a bunch of renegades. And the British saw them as a little more than a nuisance. And, as long as they had control over Newport Harbor, they thought they could shut down the state of Rhode Island. But Rhode Island, as I said, used the smaller boats, ran around the blockades, and made total fools of the British, who could not, and then any time they tried to respond, the colonists were there first, attacking them in guerrilla warfare. So the British didn't even know how to fight the Rhode Islanders. But the Bostonians learned from that tactical move and realize lining up in a line against the British meant suicide. And the only way they were going to take the British out was through small ambushes, attack, and run. And they did that time and time again. And even when it came down to the Battle of Bunker Hill, the townspeople of Charlestown, where the actual battles took place, said, okay, you're going to go up Bunker Hill, we'll be on Breed's Hill. The next hill over. So the British come marching on Bunker Hill, and there's nothing there. And the British, you know, this is when the British were going to take over and win the war. This is what they were thinking. So they finally realized their mistake. They went over to Breed's Hill, and we had ambushes set the entire way. And the British mounted assault after assault after assault. And eventually, they did win the battle. But the thing was, is that losing the battle, winning the battle, they lost 65% of their troops. And when the commander came over proudly to the general who was in charge of that battle and exclaimed, the colonists had surrendered, and they had won, the British admiral looked down at the guy who told him this and said, if we win many more battles like this, we're going to lose the war. And that's when their eyes finally opened. And the British realized they were in for a handful. And the idea is that the colonists had unified. And no matter where the British went, they got small attacks, hit-and-run attacks that they could not defend against. And that is eventually how they ended up losing the war against Americans, is that they had the greatest army in the world, but they had no idea on how to fight a group who would hit and then take off. And it's why, you know, if we ask where the creation of the Second Amendment came from, that was it. And the whole idea is by creating small militias throughout the nation, no superpower can mount a direct assault. Because who are you going to attack? And that's the whole idea. And even a superpower like our military today, with all the technology, has been proven in Afghanistan that they can't win because they can't find a unified force to fight against. And the whole idea is to make it such a pain in the butt for the other side that they eventually give up. And that is really the foundation of the Second Amendment. And they think it's over handguns and, you know, things like that, when if you actually look at the nations that have very strong rules on owning weapons, they have high rates of crime. You know, the only country in the world that has a zero murder rate with weapons, it's Switzerland. Because every citizen is required to own a gun. And one thing is, a bad guy is never going to take on an armed person because he knows that the chance of himself losing to somebody who's armed and ready for you is very high. And the people who are against guns don't understand that. And Ronald Reagan understood this, and he created a military that was so strong that no nation dared attack the U.S. Why? Because they knew that there was a force behind there that could technically destroy any nation on Earth. And it led to the fall and end of the Cold War. It was simply because we had so much power that the USSR realized all the money they had invested in their military didn't come up to 10% of what ours could do. And that ended up economically collapsing the USSR and ending the Cold War without a shot fired. And see, today people don't know, as you were saying, people don't understand economics. They don't understand that companies set up five-year programs. And I've set up written three business plans. And there's one thing called cost of goods sold. And that is figured out by the cost of the employee, the cost of the equipment, and the depreciation. It takes into account everything involved, from the building to the taxes on that building to the taxes on what they're producing. All of that needs to be figured in. And when you cannot get a decisive number as to what you're going to be paying in there and every little area, you cannot make an accurate business plan, which means that you stand to lose money. So rather than invest in an uncertain economy, their best bet is to take their money and invest it in sure short-term bonds and areas where they know they can make money on a short-term basis that will keep their stockholders happy until the economic outlook becomes better so they can do their business plans and then continue on with business as planned. There are so many companies in this country that are chomping at the bit to grow that it isn't funny. But this president is not allowing it through excessive taxation and excessive regulations. And instead, he's strangling our economy. The best way to actually get the government to make more money And to get the country back on its feet is a reduction in taxes. People see taxes are a nasty thing. And people don't understand that. Because through taxation, people think it's just punishing the big bad corporations or the rich, and that all that money is going to go to the poor. Well, fact is, return on investment when it comes to taxes is about the worst investment one can make. Because for every tax dollar given to the federal government, the return on that dollar is a dime, 10%. The other 90% goes to the government. So why should we bother wasting all that money? If a gambler went out to gamble and put out $100 and knew he'd leave the casino with 10, would he gamble? Well, I wouldn't. And that's what people don't understand. That's what we're doing today. Now, if we took that same $100 and we invested it on ourselves, we would be able to put more people back to work, which would decrease the amount of people on poverty, increase our incoming money to the government, which could decrease the national debt. And see, this administration doesn't understand that or is ignoring that basic fact in economics. And simply by, you know, companies use it all the time. They look at it and they say, well, Fred Smith is charging $10 for our product. And his he's getting X amount in profits. Well, if we charge $9 an hour for our product and we end up selling 50% more, well, in the end, we'll make more money than the guy charging $10 an hour because we're out of volume. And the more people we put back to work, the more money comes into the country. And, see, this is one thing that this president is not letting the people know. If we reduced the poverty rate down to 3 or 4%, we could be able to handle that 3%. And be able to cover their, help them and support them with a much higher standard than we are now. Today, we have such high numbers that that we can't give as much out. So, you know, we gotta teach people basic economics before they can learn and understand why a free enterprise system is the answer and taxation is not the solution. Because for every dollar they take, not only do you get a poor return on the investment, for every dollar you take out of the economy is one more dollar that is not moving through the economy. And the best way to describe a strong economy is one where money is flowing from one company to another. And that's the basis of economics. And this is what the people don't understand. And when you have too high taxes, you aren't getting as much money flowing. You're taking money, that money that could be working for the people is no longer working for the people. And in the end, the people end up losing out, even if the government tells them that it's better for them. And with that, I'll pass it back to you.
Well, amen, Dan. Hey, you know, brings us right back to Red Skelton, doesn't it? You know,
mm-hmm.
folks, we got to get on this bandwagon, I'll tell you. And we do. And Dan's got some great ideas. You know, we've got some great candidates all over the country working hard for us. We got a lot of groups and people trying to accomplish this task. But when it all comes down to it, we got to get the people out there that don't know what's going on. I'm in a lot of groups, and we share a lot of information and so on and so forth. But, you know, a lot of times we're singing to the choir. A lot of times we're singing to the choir. You know, we don't always have a lot of friends on Facebook or on Twitter that are on the left, so they don't hear what we have to say. And if we do, they hear clips. You got to get out, and you got to talk to the people. That's one of the reasons why I like K. Carl Smith and his Frederick Douglass methodology, because it requires you to get out and speak to the people. Explain to them why you believe what you believe. It's pretty simple when it all comes down to that. They have a hard time arguing that fact. I've done that all my life. I've sat down with a lot of liberals in my lifetime and said, listen, here's just the basics. And, you know, they can't argue those facts. When you want to start into getting into some of the more difficult issues, yeah, they'll argue with you all day long. But when you get into the basics and they really start to understand, it takes them right back to the founding fathers. You know what I mean, Dan?
Mm-hmm.
Here's something else I want us to cover this morning, and I just sent this guy a message. A Fall River man says he was recording a police officer who was out of control. But instead, he was arrested and his cell phone was seized. Now, the video he recorded is gone. Police say he erased it, even though they were the ones holding the phone. George Thompson says last January he was just sitting on his front porch watching a Fall River police officer working a paid detail. Thompson said the officer was on his phone and was swearing very loud. That's when Thompson pulled out his phone. Thompson says Officer Tom Bob Boza, I would say we could make some funny things out of that name. Tom Barbozo then rushed him and arrested him, charging him with unlawful wiretapping. But here's the kicker. In Massachusetts, it's perfectly legal to record video and audio of a public official, including police, as long as they are performing their duties and the recording isn't hidden. Barbozo's own police record shows that Thompson acknowledged he was recording the officer. I think we have our basic rights, and I think people should not record others secretly or surreptitiously, Fall River Police Chief Daniel Racine told WPRI. But that wasn't what he was doing, obviously. Thompson was released from jail, but police kept his phone. And that's where the story takes an interesting turn. Thompson claims that 2 days after his arrest, his phone, which was locked up at the police station, somehow had all of his video erased. If a Fall River police officer erased that video, he's fired, Chief Racine said. And I would suspect that the district attorney would take out charges. Because, of course, that's tampering with information. It's tampering with evidence. George Thompson is not buying it. They're investigating themselves, and there's a code of blue, and everyone knows that. You know, here's another example, Dan, of where our government's getting out of control. And it's sometimes getting out of control at the lower level, and we've got a lot of good law enforcement officers out there. You know, Paul Schrader running for sheriff out in San Bernardino County. He's a good man. He wants to clean up Dodge. He wants to get the insanity out. But we got a lot of these rogue guys out there that are just doing whatever they want. They're not following the laws. They're afraid of getting caught. And, you know, it's a sad situation when we start losing control of our local authorities. We got some insanity going on in Washington, D.C. on both sides, that's for sure. But we got some insanity on the local levels. And, you know, we got the same thing going on over here in just north of me, Garland School District. a good friend of mine, somebody that I really, really respect, 21-year-old Lawrence Jones. You might have seen him on Fox. You might have seen him with Project Veritas. He works with James O'Keefe a lot. He runs around Texas helping out candidates all over the place, doing some public speaking, working hard. At the same time, he is going through college and keeping up. Quite a young man. In fact, I posted about him this last week, and I said that, you know, I have a hard time remembering he's only 21 years old, because in the maturity of what he's doing and the maturity of his arguments and everything, you just kind of almost forget he's that young. But he's running for the Garland School District. He's running for the board of Garland School District because he looked and they've got a new board of directors and they've got a new superintendent that are taking the money and spending it on all kinds of stupid things, and they're trying to pull Common Core and CSCO back in. And so he finally, he talked to Rand Paul one day, and Rand Paul said, run, Lawrence, run. So Lawrence is running. Ginger Russell left me. Is running for Magnolia School Board. She's been one of the people that has fought CSCOPE harder than anybody else in the state of Texas, running for on the school board. These local races sometimes, folks, are important in these local positions. And we've got to fight there, too. When you start to see something going on amiss in your local law enforcement, Dallas has got a big problem right now. They're popping these cameras up all over the place, and now they want to be able to march and check out with the automatically just run through the computer your license plate. Some of this stuff on the local level is just as insane, too. And so, folks, you know, we've got to have a wake-up call here. It is time to stand up and fight. This country was founded on our liberties. This country was founded on immigrants. People from all over the world have come here to live the American dream legally. And we've got to stand back up for our liberty. Because, Dan, you and I both know history, and history always says this, when your government gets too big and gets too powerful and you start to get waste, fraud, and abuse, and you start to get bribes and all kinds of things going on in your government, it directly affects the freedom of the people. And I believe it's affecting it on all levels. You know, we got Don Miller. I really enjoy each week at some point in time, I get a chance to communicate one way or the other with Don Miller. We're going to have him on a show here soon. I think he's gotten kind of relaxed and gotten settled into things. Don Miller was in prison for 15 years for a crime that he didn't commit. The rape never was committed. It didn't ever happen. And you got a judge and a DA up there, Lipsky and Madden. I haven't mentioned their names in a long time. I think I'm going to start again. You know, just corrupt. Ricky Madden, Judge Madden, a man who's been caught masturbating in public. talk about a creep. In charge of the local law enforcement up there in Hurley, Wisconsin, and getting away with things for years and years and years because it's a small area and can't get the news media to say anything. Folks, these are the things that we're talking about. And if you don't want to wake up in 20 more years and have it a whole lot worse than it is now, all you got to do is look back 10 years ago and see where we were at then and where we're at now. Where are we going to be in another 20 years? Of course, technology has a lot to do with this. Technology is providing the government with more and more ways of keeping track of us, data mining and all kinds of things, the NSA and the IRS. But, folks, you know, we got to stand up and fight it. We can win this battle. We can win this battle if we stand up and fight it. And so with that, Dan, we're getting ready to get to the top of the hour already again. I'm not quite sure exactly how that happens each week. We have so much fun. We're the bottom of the hour. We got about a half an hour left. But I want to pass it back to you for your comments on that. And we'll let you, and then we'll after that, we'll start running around for our closing remarks.
Okay. You know, there's a saying that's been, you know, it's many, many years old, and it says, you reap what you sow. And we have this movement going on called the grassroots movement, where we're actually creating candidates from the very beginning with the understanding that we're going to be following you through every step of the way. And I am hoping that we can put together that every 6 months we post these candidates' voting records so that they can be seen by the people, and we can see whether or not this person is following through on what they promised. And those who do will move on to the next stage, which is state government. And once, if they still continue to follow along on their voting record, on what they campaigned on and what we voted for them, then we can bring them on to a federal level. It accomplishes three things. It accomplishes that our local government is honest. It cleans up our state government, and it will clean up our federal government. And that's the whole key behind the grassroots movement, is that you can keep track of all three. And, you know, on a local basis, you got to be willing to talk to everybody. And once a month, as you know, I don't have a lot of mobility, but once a month I go to the firing range so that I am good enough with my gun to be able to protect my family. And it just so happens last week when I went in to do my monthly training of myself was police day. So I was surrounded by local police, and I started discussing the grassroots movement and the whole idea that, you know, one asks what we are doing. And I said, it's real simple. I said, we're following the Constitution of the United States. And I said that, and I said, for any candidate I want to vote for, there's three simple things I want them to follow, whether they're Democrats or Republicans. The first thing I want them to is God. I said the second thing I want them to follow is the Constitution. And the third is belief in country. And I said, if we have those three simple things on both sides of the aisle, I said, we can solve 90% of our problems. I said, take away any of the three, and you're going to have problems. And the whole belief needs to be is that, you see, our forefathers, when they created this Constitution, they didn't just throw these amendments together. Each one was thought out very carefully. And the whole idea is that the people have the ability and the right to protect themselves, that there is no centralized government. See, by having every state having its own state government, it distributes power amongst our 50 states. And our government should be about 50% smaller. So they have no more power than any of the states either. But what happened is that through all these pork programs, they have established so many departments that are unnecessary. And, you know, it has also gave them a lot of power. And the first thing they do is they attack Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, and they call them entitlements. Well, I don't know about you, But for my, 30-some years of work, there was a little thing on my paycheck that said FDIC. And that is the money I invested every month into Social Security with the promise that I could get that back when I retired. And now the federal government, anytime anything happens, the first thing they attack are the very thing that we put our money into, invested from 30 to 60 years, depending on a person's work career. Those aren't entitlements. Entitlements are things that you did not pay for. And Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare are things we paid for. So, and they're the first three things they attack. Now, I've been going through also the number of departments in the federal government, and I am not even halfway through, and my number is up to over 3,000, most of which mean nothing. Yet their annual budgets are in the tens of millions of dollars. Now, we want to solve, the first thing you hear when you ask to, stop giving the government money is, oh, we got to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. The three non-entitlement things in our country. Instead, why don't we say, why don't you cut out the program that you're studying, how much fat is on a pig, that you're putting $200 million in a year to? Why don't we cut out the meeting calls of the gecko that we're putting $20 million a year to? Why don't we cut out the program that measures the growth of grass on a country club that you're putting $400 million to? And these are the types of stupid programs that our federal government has that can be eliminated. And I bet without a doubt that we can remove 70% of these departments that serve no real purpose. And in doing so, we can support our military, support our veterans, support Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare, and actually the government would be ahead. But since these are the programs that buy in these elected officials, they don't want to touch them. Well, they have to learn something that us grassroots people do already know, is that you got to put the country ahead of everything. This isn't a place for you to make money. This isn't a place for you to buy votes. You're supposed to do this for the better of the nation and not for the better of yourself. Our forefathers all gave everything they had to create this nation, and what you're doing is taking everything you can. What private sector job after 4 years will give you full pay and full benefits for the rest of your lives? Does Congress deserve that? No. Does the Senate deserve that? No. You reap what you sow. And you know, it's we the people who made that mistake, and now it's time to right that wrong, and we're going to let Congress know that the days are over when you're going to milk this country into oblivion. This is a country of the people, by the people, for the people. We are very proud of what our ancestors created, and they are making a mockery of it. And I will be the first one to say it to them directly to Congress. They should all be ashamed of themselves to hold up a big pad of paper and say, you got to pass it before you can read it. Now, would anybody go to a used car dealership and have the car salesman say, yeah, buy the car before you can drive it? That was the most asinine thing I've ever heard in my life. And yes, Nancy Pelosi, you should be ashamed of yourself. But you have no shame. And then you have another person who, when asked about the killing of an ambassador, his aide, and two Navy SEALs, and when asked about it, says, so? The deaths of American people, and this woman has the audacity to say so, and now she wants to run for president. I would rather vote Miss Piggy in than her. It's time to start waking up people. It's time to start seeing who these people are. We have a president that gave up 16 of our bravest men, SEAL Team 6. Not only did they violate the secrecy of the team, they also allowed the helicopter of which they were flying in to be shot down. Of the SEAL team that went in to save the rest of the embassy staff in Benghazi, who decided to ignore the stand down order, are now in Fort Leavenworth for saving 30 Americans. Had they not made that move, those 30 Americans would be dead. Are we allowed to talk to any of them? No. This should tell you the hypocrisy and the dishonesty that's going on in our federal government today. And it's time we stood up as a people in solidarity from both sides of the aisle. And we said, we need to say, as the people, that we aren't going to take it anymore. Because I know Democrats are just pissed off about this administration as Republicans. And you can see the Democratic Party starting to turn their back on this president. And it's time to come in May or June, and I want all of you to come with us and stand in the mall, and we'll have speakers, and we're going to have a delegation addressing Congress at the same time. It's time for the people to stand up and say enough is enough. And with that, I'll pass it back to you, Scott.
Well, and it is. It's about time to stand up and say enough is enough. And you know, you brought up another good point that I just want to hit on, and then we're working on about 12 minutes from the end of the show. You know, Nancy Pelosi. Barbara Boxer. You know they're both so stupid. Barbara Boxer. Can you please call me Senator? I've worked so hard to earn that title. You know, and I'm glad she said that. I really am glad she said that. Because it really, really shows exactly who they are. She's supposed to be a servant of the people. She was elected to serve her constituents. She's placed herself in the position of being a bond servant. She's not smarter than everybody else. That's not why she won. She wasn't put in there to be a king or a queen or a big decision maker. She was there. She's there to take the opinions of her constituents, the needs and the wants of her constituents, and take them to Washington, D.C., and to fight for them. And, you know, when you have to say that in the first place, number one, Barbara Boxer, I sure wish you were listening to this, maybe NSA, if you can ship her a copy of this. You know, number one, when you say something like that, it shows weakness on your part. A lot of people don't understand the concept of weak and strong. You know, when a person uses a lot of foul language in their daily vocabulary, you know, you've heard those kind of people. Every other word is a four-letter word. That doesn't make them look tough. What it does is it makes them look like they've got a very weak vocabulary, because people only do that when they can't find the words to fill in somewhere else. The person that's got tattoos all over their body, you know, and I'm not against, you know, there's some tattoos here and there, but when the people that wear tattoos all over their body, a peacock only shows its feathers when it's afraid. And that's a peacock showing its feathers. It's trying to show outward toughness because what's on the inside is really actually insecure. Gang members, you know, it always cracked me up. I think if you took the modern-day gangsta and put him up against somebody like Al Capone, you're talking about a freshman and a senior in high school. Somebody's going to end up upside down in the trash can. So the concept of weak and strong are concepts we really don't really analyze fully through. And what Barbara Boxer did by saying that was really show weakness. She showed insecurity on behalf of herself, that she had to rely on her title instead of her accomplishments. She had to rely on her title instead of her leadership ability. Anybody that turns around and has to point out who they are, that's just a big sign of weakness. So I'm really glad, Barbara, that you said that, because I've been able for the last 10 years to use it, that illustration, in many times. But it's emblematic of our the attitude of most of the people we've got in Washington, D.C., a lot of the people we got in our state houses. It's just an insane situation where people are too big for the britches. They're supposed to be leaders. They're supposed to be servants. They're supposed to be serving the constituents of the United States. And instead, they're doing things that are helping to promote themselves. You know, and I don't have a problem with somebody becoming wealthy. I know that when you get to go to Washington, D.C., after you leave, there's going to be lots of opportunities to become wealthy. Great thing. However, folks, when you start doing your job based on that, like Bob Corker, Cork the Dork there in Tennessee, you can just follow his money trail. That's all you got to do. You just follow his money trail, and you can follow his votes. He's no longer voting with his constituents. He votes with the Obama administration 60% of the time when it counts. That's not a Republican. And if you want to be, if Bob Corker wanted to be a Democrat, I'd be all for that. You know, if you're on the far left and you believe socialism is great, all to you, man. That's what you believe. I'll stand by your right to believe what you believe. I'll tell you you're wrong. I'll tell you that history will bear out that you're wrong. I'll tell you that logic bears out you're wrong, but you got the right to believe what you want to believe. If you're on the right, I feel the same way. But I got a real character problem with people that are on the right, but turn around and vote on the left because it benefits them. And that's what Bob Corker does. You know, it all comes back down to character. And, man, boy, you say a mouthful when you start talking about some of these people. Hillary Clinton. You know, I've never liked the Clintons. I've got some problems with them, although I've always given them credit where credit's due. I think they're brilliant politicians. I think their political machine is very, very well oiled and runs very well. Barack Obama beat that machine using the grassroots, so that should tell you something about the power of the grassroots. But the Clintons have always been pretty sharp when it comes to politics. I don't agree with their politics. I don't agree with the direction they go. But I, you know, when Hillary was a senator, I gave her some credit. I really gave her some credit. Didn't agree with her positions, but man, I'm going to tell you, she was a hard worker. She was one of the most hardworking congressmen. She wasn't out trying to benefit herself. She was out running around working on the things that she believed in. And I gave her respect for that. And she was Secretary of State. I gave her respect, man. She was a hard worker. She was outgoing all the time, doing the president's bidding. I didn't agree with that bidding, but she was out there doing it. And then she got into Benghazi. And then all of a sudden it all stopped. She started lying. And I think that, again, Dan, is a sign of weakness. I think it shows she got herself into a weak position and didn't know how to get herself out. I believe she got herself into a position where she was trying to run around and do the best she could at doing a good job of what she was supposed to do, at the same time balancing the insanity of this White House. She gets to Benghazi. The president's starting to do things that are dangerous. And instead of standing up to her side and saying, wait a minute, no, this is not right, I got to do my job here, she just fell down. And now she's in the position of doing a bunch of lying and excuse-making, and you know, she'll be forever. She'll go to her grave with the clip, what difference does it make? She knows what difference it makes. When you have to make the statement, what difference does it make, then you know it makes a difference. You know it makes a difference. Otherwise, you don't have to defend it. Shows weakness on her part, and I'm sorry to see that, because like I say, I've never agreed with her on the issues by a long shot, but as a hard worker, she's always impressed me. Working on the wrong side, wish she was working on our side. Wish she was a conservative working on our side. Hard worker. But man, she fell down through the cracks, and I think that falling down through the cracks is what's going to keep her from being president of the United States. Thank goodness, I believe that, because I believe there's a lot of people on the Democratic side that want character in their office, too. They may believe what they believe, but they want good character on their side, and she fell down on the character issue on this one. And we've got lots of people in Washington, D.C. doing this all the time. And, you know, that's why it's time, folks. You got to start looking at your candidates. I'm going to give it another push. Look at your candidates. Look at their character, what they believe in. You know, my two biggies here in Texas won this last week, the primary. Now, they're both headed for a runoff because the vote was close enough. Texas has got some funny runoff laws. I'm not quite sure I like them yet. I want to see a winner on primary day, unless, you know, you're with a few votes. But Connie Burton, she won. She came out on top. Now she's got a runoff. And I've talked to Phil Burton and Connie Burton personally about this, and they both have been looking forward to this runoff. They know they've got it. They've got they were hoping the hard accomplishment was the primary. They knew if they ended up in a runoff, they would be fine. So they're really excited about that. That's coming up in May, so we'll give her an extra added push as we get there, hoping to have her on Blog Talk here soon. And Sid Miller is in the same boat. Sid Miller is going to go to the runoff, and he feels pretty confident himself in a runoff election in May. So we push those. We've got another election, and then in the general election, well, you know, Dan, everything's bigger here in Texas, including the elections. Just when you think you got the primary over and you're headed to the general, no, we got to throw another election in there. But I'll tell you, I support those guys, and I talk about them a lot because I know their character. Man, Sid Miller, he's a solid conservative. And Connie Burton, she's a solid conservative, and she's grassroots all the way. She was partially responsible for helping Ted Cruz win that election. She was very, very, very active in that. They're both solid conservatives. But there's a lot of solid conservatives running around that when they get to Washington, D.C., they'll turn around and be bought off. Bob Corker used to be a solid conservative, so that should tell you enough. But Connie Burton and Sid Miller both have got something very, very special besides that, and that's their character. That's their fight. That's their sand. I believe Sid Miller said it the best when he defined the difference between a statesman and a politician. And a statesman will stand up for what he believes in, even if it's going to hurt him. And a politician won't stand up for what he believes in, as long as it's not going to make him some money. And that's what ends up being insane. So, you know, Dan, we've had a good show, great conversation, some great history. I'm going to pass it back to you for your closing remarks, and then I'll close out the show.
Okay, we'll do a quickie on this. You know something, this is what's so important with the grassroots, is that by starting at the local level and watching the person grow as they go higher and higher into government, you find out what their character is. And then by the time you send them to Washington, know who they are and that they are not going to fall to the almighty dollar, and they're going to stand behind their convictions. And this is what we need in Washington. We don't need sell-offs. We don't need these people who say that they're going to stand for one thing and then the next thing change their mind because they know they can make more money because there's some lobbyist out there offering big bucks. You know something that none of these politicians understand is you have to look yourself in the mirror every morning and you have to be at see, and if you aren't, you don't belong in that position. And there's something called integrity. And if you don't have integrity, you don't belong in our government. And it's sad to say most of the people in our federal government today are lacking that. Nancy Pelosi and Barbara Boxer don't even know what the word means. And same with Dianne Feinstein and the whole group. You know, I left California for that reason. Is that, you know, I'm not going to stand for a person who doesn't have honor and integrity. And I won't stand beside them. I've been writing in my blog, you know how George Washington made it to president is by being very saying, I'm not deserving of this. He was very, he never was pushing for himself. But he pushed like heck for the country. Same as Franklin. And these are the politicians we need. These are the kinds of people we need in our government today. The ones who are willing to push for the country and put their own personal lives and their personal goals and aspirations aside for what's good for the country. And with that, all I ask people is remember, whether you're left or right, the first thing you need to ask your politicians where they stand. You first have to ask them where they stand when it comes to God, where they stand when it comes to the Constitution, and do they believe in their country? Because without those three things, they have nothing to offer us. And with that, I'll return back to you, Scott.
Amen, Dan. And great show. And, you know, folks, we just ask you, just keep coming. Keep on keeping on. We're going to end the show with Keep On Keeping On. We've got some great shows coming up. We've got something really special coming up on Mondays. We will keep you apprised on that as soon as that happens. Of course, Tuesday night, Dan and I get together with Jennifer Montrose on Parental Sovereignty. We talk from everything from Common Core to politics. We had a great guest on last week, Eddie Fulmer, working with Bama. Bama, Alabama. Boy, Dan, sometimes I should have notes right in front of me because I think I'm going to remember something and I don't. Bama Carry, they're in Alabama. BamaCarry.org. Look that up. BamaCarry. Look it up, and you'll see what I'm talking about. Man, he was an inspiring guest. Lots of enthusiasm. Have some great people on that show. On Thursday nights, remember, not on Continue for Truth Radio anymore, but on their own network, the IRP6 group, working hard. Friday. Ladies Bible class. I had a rough one this week. You know, that transition between the end of 2 Samuel and the beginning of 1 Kings, it's kind of blah in some ways. A lot of stuff to cover. Some really beautiful stuff. The 18th Psalm is repeated in there. And some fun stories. But it was a couple of hours where I almost felt like I was pushing myself. But next Friday, we get really into the meat of the story of Solomon and his son Rehoboam and when the Israel splits in half between Judah and Israel. Looking forward to that. Ladies Bible class every Friday. That's at 10:30 California time, 11:30, 12:30 Texas time, and 1:30 your time, Dan. I've been doing that for 5 years now, and I love it. I miss giving my ladies the hugs every Friday morning, and I miss the cinnamon rolls, but we're having a great time. And then back here Saturday for Contending for Truth Radio Saturday Symposium with Dan Wilson. And got some other things coming up. We got some allotted time spots here on Contending for Truth Radio. Going to work on seeing if we can fill one or two of those and some great things coming up. So we want to thank everybody for joining us this morning. Thank you, Dan. It was great as always. And we're going to rock it out with D-Rock Country. Keep on keeping on. Go to drockcountry.com and find out his music. Great patriot, man. Good man. Great patriot. Love him dearly. Him and his Kimmy working hard as patriots. Keep on keeping on.
There will be days that just go wrong, make you wanna holler and shout, hands up in the air, wondering what it's all about. Mm-hmm. And you think that things can't get much worse in a second. Oh, everything just goes south. Keep on keeping on. Whatever don't kill you makes you strong. Don't you worry, it won't be long. Darkness comes before the dawn. Take it one day at a time. God's grace, you're gonna be fine. You got what it takes down in time. Road ain't alone. Keep on keeping on. Stand in your way.
They're always saying,
always saying what you cannot do. Mm-hmm. Don't stop chasing your dreams and working hard to make them come true. Oh. And if it ever gets too tough, just remember. Don't kill you, makes you strong. Don't you worry, it won't be long. Darkness comes before the dawn. Take it one day at a time. With God's grace, you're gonna be fine. You got what it takes down inside. The road ain't alone. Keep on keeping on.
don't kill you, makes you strong. Don't you worry, it won't be long. Darkness comes before the dawn.